Energy use is the basis of being well off. Poor sucks. Rich, not so sucky. If the UK went net zero by 2050, the impact right now on climate would be zero. So we would literally impoverish ourselves and do no good. That's just stupid. Polar bears was this iconic species. We probably estimate there was less than 10,000 polar bears. Today, that number is up around 26,000. So we've seen a dramatic increase. Why?
Hello, I'm Fraser Myers, Deputy Editor of Spiked. I'm absolutely thrilled to be joined by Bjorn Lomborg. Bjorn's written a prolific amount of books and articles on the climate issue, on the environment. Most recently, Best Things First and False Alarm. Bjorn, welcome.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Bjorn, we're at a time when I think it's fair to say that skepticism towards net zero and climate policy has gone mainstream. We have Donald Trump in the US talking and saying, drill, baby, drill. Even in the UK, the Conservative Party, which actually introduced net zero into the UK law, has gone cold on the idea. Is this a welcome development in your view?
It certainly is good that we're now more realistic. Remember, climate change is a real problem, but it's not this end of the world that it's been sold. And the problem with this whole conversation is, when you think this is the end of the world, when you think this is a meteor hurtling towards Earth, nothing else matters. And that's, of course, how the conversation has been for the last 10, 15 years. The world is ending, so we just got to do everything and pay whatever it costs. Mm. That has led to a lot of really, really bad policies. Now, it's still a problem, so we shouldn't throw everything out with the bathwater. So I want to make sure that we don't sort of go all the way to the other side and just say, drill, baby, drill, and don't care about anything. The point here is to say, stop doing all the stupid stuff that cost us trillions and actually doesn't help fix climate change. Let's still fix climate change, but let's fix it much cheaper and much more effectively and much smarter.
And let's talk a bit about the stupid stuff. I think there's been a lot of stupid stuff in Europe in particular. I'm thinking of places like Germany that seem to be just on the path to deindustrialization, largely, not entirely, but largely in part to net zero. The UK is really, really struggling with its economy right now. Why? Can you explain why it's so dangerous for the economy? Why it has had such a terrible impact?
Well, fundamentally, if you're talking about net zero, you very easily end up saying, so we got to make everything into renewables. So solar and wind are the most favorite policies. But the problem, of course, is you can't actually run a country or an economy on something that only works sometimes. Mm. So it's great when the wind is shining, when the sun is shining and the wind is blowing, but other times those costs are infinite. So you can't run your country in this. Either you need an immense amount of batteries. A lot of people sort of in their minds believe, oh, we can make that work out. But the reality, of course, is most countries around the world have storage capacity for, say, 10 or 20 minutes of their electricity system, but you actually need something that goes for a month or 3 months. So we're far, far away. And remember, this is not just a tiny bit at current cost. This, for instance, for the US, would cost the US about a third of its GDP every year. So there's just no way, because you have to buy these batteries every 15 years or so. So the fundamental point here is, this is not something that we can just snap our fingers and hope it goes away. What happens is that you keep pushing in more solar and wind, and the prices go up. If you make a graph, and I've done this, if you take a graph of how much solar and wind constitutes of your entire electricity production, and then look at what's the price, there's a very clear upward trend. The more solar and wind you have, the higher the cost. And the crucial bit here is, there is no country on Earth that has lots of solar and wind and low energy cost. So people want to tell you, oh, it's going to be so cheap in the future, but it's actually not. And that's, of course, why, for instance, heavy industries, all the chemical industries leave Germany, because you don't want to pay for really, really high costs of solar and wind. Instead, you move to the US where it's cheap, or you move to China or elsewhere in Southeast Asia. And the real point of that is, of course, then the Germans have just done something to make themselves feel good. they sort of virtue signal and say, ah, see, we fixed the climate problem for us. But it was never about fixing it for Germany. It was about fixing it for the entire world. And as long as you don't get China, India, and Africa on board, you've missed out on most of the emissions in the 21st century. So the reality is you're not going to show the way by impoverishing yourself. Nobody's going to look at Germany and say, ooh, we want to be like Germany. They look at Germany and say, see, that's what we have to avoid. We need to get back on track for policies that actually showcase how to do eventually fixing climate change, not how not to do it, which unfortunately is what we've become champions of the last 10, 20 years.
And what about nuclear energy? I mean, nuclear is carbon free, and yet it seems to still be despised by a lot of environmentalists. But there is also the cost of nuclear seems to at least be quite high initially. Are there ways that we can get around that? I mean, is nuclear a potential solution to this?
Oh, nuclear is absolutely a potential solution. So remember, a lot of Greens' DNA was sort of built back when it was about being against nuclear power. So I understand the sort of reluctance, but the fundamental point remains. If you have built nuclear power plants, you've already gotten all the waste. You've already committed to decommissioning them. You've already paid for them. You should definitely not decommission them now, which is what Germany and many other countries around the world, also many in the US, have done. That's just stupid. You basically have free green energy that you could run for 10, 20, 30 years, and instead you say, nah, let's not do that. That's just plain stupid. And I think nobody can disagree with the idea that we should keep the existing nuclear power plants running. But you're right, with the current third generation nuclear power plants, it has turned out to be fairly costly in the rich world, not in the poor part of the world, which is remarkable. And that seems to suggest that this is really a regulatory issue rather than anything else. We're simply designing each one of these new nuclear power plants as if it was an opera house. So we have to do everything right and, you know, no cost to spare. And of course, that ends up making very, very expensive power. I think we're probably never going to get that right in the West. But there's the promise of fourth generation nuclear, which is very often a sort of small modular reactors. You type approve them in the factory, and then you just roll out 100,000 of them. That's a much, much cheaper. So you don't make one opera house and then another opera house and so on, but you just roll them out from the factory floor. That potentially could make nuclear power incredibly cheap and very, very safe. But of course, we have to remember that was also what they told us about the other three generations of nuclear power plants. It would be incredibly cheap and, you know, we'd just be inundated with cheap nuclear power. That didn't happen. So, you know, we should be focusing on seeing, is there a way to make this happen? And the way, of course, is to make sure that we make these demonstration plants, that we invest in research and development to make sure that we get all the smartest things. This could be nuclear. It could be a lot of other technologies. I mean, it could even be solar and wind with lots and lots of incredibly cheap battery power. I don't quite see how that's going to work right now, but we should be investigating it. And the point here is we need to find the next generation of some technology that's so cheap that it's cheaper than fossil fuels and still incredibly green. That could be fourth generation nuclear power, could be a lot of other things. But once we have that technology, everyone will switch. We don't need all those UN high-powered meetings where everybody tries to twist everybody else's arm to do stuff they don't want to do. Everyone would just switch, not just rich, well-meaning Brits and other people from the rich world, but also, and crucially, the Chinese, the Indians, and the Africans.
And of course, fossil fuels still rule the world. They still account for about 80% of all the world's energy use, and I believe the net zero transition has barely dented that at all. Why are fossil fuels so essential, really, to the modern economy?
So what you have to remember, and I think a lot of people forget this because we live very comfortable lives, energy use is the basis of being well off. You know, fundamentally, there's no country in the world that's well off and has little energy. Energy is what makes our world go around. Energy is what makes this conversation possible, but it was also what makes it possible for me to live in, you know, freaking Sweden, which is pretty darn cold in the winter, and makes it possible for me to get around and get food. You know, remember, half of all food is grown with fertilizer that's basically made from gas. We have no sense of how incredibly everything in our world is intertwined with the access to energy. And much of this energy, as you point out, more than 80% of the energy comes from fossil fuels. So trying to say, oh, let's just get rid of it as the sort of, the fossil, just stop oil argument. No, you can't just stop oil and coal and gas. If you did, billions of people would die. You know, very literally, 4 billion people would die because we just wouldn't have enough food because we wouldn't have the fertilizer for them. But many other people would die in many other ways. And of course, nobody is going to say yes to that, which is why you need a lot of energy. Now, we're a smart civilization. Eventually, we can imagine switching mostly away from fossil fuels, which are very, very dense and cheap and very readily available, but have the negative impact of climate change, to other technologies. But we can't do that unless it's cheaper. We will never get most of the world on board. We can feel virtues in Sweden or in Britain or somewhere else and feel like, oh, wow, we're really doing something. But remember, if the European Union by itself and the UK went net zero by 2050, the impact right now on climate would be zero, obviously. But it would also be nearly zero by mid-century. If you plug this into the UN climate model, it would be about 0.02 degrees less warmer by mid-century. That's just nothing. We wouldn't be able to measure. And even by the end of the century, it would still be 0.09 degrees, less than 0.1 degree lower than it otherwise would have been. We would just simply leave the whole world unchanged, but the cost for the UK and the EU would be vastly beyond £100 trillion over the 21st century. So we would literally impoverish ourselves and do no good. That's just stupid. And that's also what the economic analysis showed, that the benefit-cost ratio is really low for doing this. On the other hand, if we focus on making innovation go much faster into green innovation, we haven't. We've actually promised to do that, but we haven't. If we do that, we can spend about 1/20th of the cost that we're spending right now. And we could achieve much, much more, because if we could help innovate the price of green energy down below fossil fuels, everyone would switch.
And could you just give a sense of what you think the real risks are with climate change? Because it's clear that you said it's a challenge, but not the end of the world. Many people might hear that and they could start spitting feathers. You know, you talked about Just Stop Oil. They really believe, you know, they clearly are motivated by the fact that they believe that the world will end unless we take drastic, radical action. Can you lay out what the real risks are?
Yes. So it's not surprising that a lot of people think the world is ending, because that's what the media is telling you every day. And remember, there's a huge payoff for media to take whatever negative story and say, see, climate change. But you're very badly informed on this if you just take the media's word for this. So if you actually read the UN climate panel, they tell us, yes, it's a problem. They do not at all tell us this is, by any standard or stretch of the imagination, the end of the world. The reason why the media tells you this is the exact same reason as what we've seen in the US over the last three decades. FBI statistics universally show that crime has gone down dramatically by, it's dropped by half or 2/3. Yet if you survey most people in the US, they think crime has gone up. Why? Because now we have CNN and 24/7 news channels across the political spectrum. And of course, there's enough crime to tell you all the time, hey, here's another crime. Oh, here's another crime. So it makes you believe that there's more crime. But if you actually look at the data, so for instance, take fire. Most people think, oh my God, the world is on fire. I mean, indeed, New York Times tells you it's a world on fire. But the reality is we have had satellites since the late 1990s from NASA covering the world 24/7 that is picking up all major fires in the world. And what we know is the area of fire in the world, so all the stuff that burns every year, has gone down by about 25%. You would never know if you look at the media, because you never send out a reporter and say, I'm out here reporting and there's no fire, right? You only have reporters out saying, oh my God, it's all burning. But again, this is the fallacy of what the crime rate in the US is. You believe just because you see more and more of the stuff in the media that that must be mean that there's more and more of it. Now, remember, climate economists have spent about 30 years trying to investigate. So what is the total net impact of climate change? So there are many negatives. There is also some positive. As temperatures rise, you're going to see fewer cold waves and hence fewer people dying from cold. That matters a lot because a lot of people die from cold in this world. But overall, it's a net negative. But how much? Well, actually, the only climate economist to win the Nobel Prize in climate economics, William Nordhaus from Yale University, last year did a meta study. That is, taking all the studies that we have of all the negative and positive impacts and trying to estimate, so what will be the net negative impact by the end of the century? Another one, Richard Tull, who is at Sussex University, one of the most quoted climate economists in the world, also did last year a meta study. They both came to the conclusion that the cost of climate change by the end of the century is equivalent to 2 to 3% loss by the end of the century. So, yeah, not nothing. Certainly not 100%, but, you know, 2 to 3% is a real issue. So if you can come up with a solution that costs, say, a percent of GDP and solves most of the 2 to 3% of the problem, that's great. Unfortunately, what Europe and many others, smart people who are really scared and running around, you know, sort of with their heads cut off, they end up saying, let's spend 10% badly on not really cutting very much of the 2 to 3% problem in 100 years. That's just stupid. And also, just to, you know, sort of relax the people who would worry a lot, to get a sense of proportion, the 2 to 3% cost by the end of the century is of a much, much richer world. That means our kids and grandkids are going to be much better off, but slightly less, much better off. The UN estimate the average person on the planet by the end of the century will be 450% as rich as he or she is today, which is a fantastic world. Because of climate change, a reduction of 2 to 3%, that will feel like you're only somewhere between 435 to 440% as rich by the end of the century. Yes, that's a problem. We'd rather have we were 450% as rich, but it's still a fantastic world. It's a much, much better world. It's just a slightly less, much better world. That's a very different understanding of this. And of course, not the one that you see on TV where you just see, oh my God, another fire. But this is the reality. This is what the period research in economics actually show you. Problem, 2 to 3%, not the end of the world.
And to what extent is growing the economy, having a more prosperous society, in and of itself a solution? I mean, if you think about natural disasters of any kind, recently, you know, there's been an earthquake in East Asia. That's going to be pretty devastating over there. But if it hit Japan in the middle of Tokyo, you know that no one would have died. You know, sometimes natural disasters, the impact they have seems to be entirely dependent on the prosperity of the society they hit. Can we apply that same thinking to climate change?
Oh, absolutely. Getting people out of poverty is probably one of the best climate policies you can have, because if a hurricane hits a poor Guatemala, it kills tens of thousands of people and it destroys their economy. If the same hurricane hits Florida, it kills a couple of people and it destroys a little bit of the production in a couple of months. Again, this is not to downplay the issue, but it's simply to recognize that what keeps most people safe is that they're not poor. Poor sucks. Rich, not so sucky. And so the reality here is lifting people out of poverty is not just good for climate, but of course, it's also good for everything else. It means that you can keep your kids better fed. You can get them into a better school. You can make sure that they don't die from easily curable infectious diseases and all these other things. So absolutely, one of the things that we should do to fix climate change is to make sure that people are no longer poor. We should make sure that there's a lot of growth so that people get better off. And of course, one of the things that the German approach does not allow, and in some sense, also the British approach, doing a lot of net zero means that you're going to be much less resilient to climate disasters in the future because you're relatively poorer and less well off. Again, just to give you one example of the statistics, over the last 100 years, You know, most people think that we're seeing more and more climate catastrophes. That's actually not true. There's a few things and a few categories in which things are getting worse. As I mentioned, we see more heat waves. We also see fewer cold waves and so on. But if you measure the total impact on lives lost from floods, droughts, storms, and wildfires, it is such that we have good data for at least 100 years. In the 1920s, so 100 years ago, on average, about 500,000 people died each year from these disasters. Mm-hmm. The last 10 years, 10,000 or a little bit less than 10,000 people die. 98% fewer. Not because of climate change. It's possible that there's a climate change signal below all of this. But because development, because people stopped being poor, because we got much better technology and much better ability to project, that has saved many, many more people. And so, again, it just goes to your point of saying, if you want to save people, make sure that they're not poor.
And final question, what about the poor polar bears? What are they going to do? Where do they fit into all this?
Well, the surprising thing is polar bears was this iconic species that a lot of people said they were going to die out. And Al Gore obviously featured them in his film, and they were very, very big in the knots. It's sort of remarkable that we don't really hear about them anymore. Mm. And the main reason is they're not going extinct or anything close thereby. If you actually look at the official estimates of how many polar bears we have, they used to be really threatened. Back in the 1960s, we probably estimate there was less than 10,000 polar bears, possibly as low as 5,000 polar bears. Today, that number is up around 26,000. So we've seen a dramatic increase. Why? Because we stopped shooting polar bears. It's really very, very simple. And I'm always very surprised when people then say, oh, but we got to, you know, basically recalibrate the entire global economy and make everyone poor in order to save polar bears by making sure that we cut carbon emissions, which is sort of a very roundabout way when you think about it. Right now, every year, Inuits and other local people shoot polar bears. They shoot about 700 to 800 polar bears each year. If you really care about the polar bears, why the hell are we saying, let's reshape the entire global economy at a cost of tens of trillions of dollars each year instead of, I don't know, stop shooting the polar bears? And this is what's happened when you're so scared witless, when you can only think about one thing, namely climate change, you forget that there are often very simple and very smart and very cheap solutions to much of the things that you worry about. So first of all, polar bears are not in danger. They're actually increasing numbers. And if you really want to do something about them, stop shooting.
Bjørn Lomborg, thank you very much.
Thank you.